You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I am your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 39. This minute opens with Shaw asking Holloway, "Do you have the carbon reader?" and ends with David saying, "Remarkably human," as he approaches the statue of the engineer head.
"How long's it been dead?"
2,000 years, give or take.
How convenient. Clearly, such a date was chosen very purposefully. They are trying to connect it to a certain biblical event. I'll leave that up to your imagination as to which one specifically. As mentioned previously, Ridley has gone on record saying that he believes that Jesus was an engineer, and because we crucified him, the engineers were going to wipe us out. Rubbish. Sorry, Sir Ridley, but nowhere is Jesus described as an 8-foot-tall, bald, white, muscular dude. It just doesn't add up. We see Shaw using some kind of device to analyze a carbon sample. Carbon dating, or carbon-14 dating to be precise, doesn't work like this. It's not a universal system of measurement. It is strictly based on Earth-specific environment and variables. Namely, the carbon in the atmosphere. Now, we could say that they know the content of the atmosphere. We did hear Chance and Ravel and Ford giving readings. However, this still assumes that the engineer is a carbon-based life form. It also makes assumptions about its diet. It very likely was not even eating food native to the planet. Either way, how could they know that the food was carbon-based? Let us not forget that everything in this temple is seemingly perfectly preserved, as if it had only been abandoned relatively recently. So, even assuming they had taken all these calculations into account and calibrated their carbon reader accordingly, at best, that engineer might only read as having been dead for a few years or a few decades. Carbon dating is a fairly complicated system, and naturally I am giving you the abridged explanation, but there is a helpful video in the footnotes should you wish to delve deeper. Is this a major flaw? Not really. Honestly, I'm more irritated by the 2,000 years reference than the notion of carbon readers that magically work on newly discovered planets. If they have lifelike AI and floating drones, sure, magic carbon dating devices are par for the course. Perhaps one way of avoiding this inaccuracy was simply by not using the term carbon dating at all. Just use some generic sci-fi term, a molecular dating device or the neutron dating device. Such a simple alteration could have been the difference between misinformation and pure fantasy. I'm not one of those people who is all that bothered by scientific inaccuracies in films. If anything, they inspire a heap of people on the internet to discuss why it is inaccurate, and everyone else can learn from it. I don't think Hollywood has any responsibility to its audience to present accuracy in any way, scientifically, historically, or otherwise. However, what I am bothered by is when the science actually presents a cooler alternative, but the writers go for something generic and inaccurate. That's about it. I guess this all ties back to the question, is this movie soft sci-fi or hard sci-fi? Prometheus didn't even have a science advisor, as many Hollywood films do these days. Clearly, science was not a top priority. Though that is a bit of a shame, because as it stands, it's in this weird middle ground where it wants to explain everything, but also just wants to be an action horror film. The other Alien films don't try to explain too much, and therefore it allows an audience to suspend their disbelief more readily. It also makes things scarier. What is this creature? Where did it come from? How did it get here? No one knows. What it ultimately comes down to is that the writer has an obligation to fulfill the promises they made in the first act. If this is going to be a hard sci-fi, stick to it. If this is going to be a dumb horror action movie, commit to that. That's why you don't hear much scientific nitpicking over movies like Transformers. Those movies never made the promise of scientific realism. Therefore, we, the audience, are more inclined to let the more fantastic elements slide. on that topic, Star Trek is a weird one because a lot of it is very soft sci-fi and is more interested in presenting fantastic settings as a means of exploring allegories for political, philosophical, and social issues. But sometimes it does get very scientific. Therefore, we have endless nerd debates over it, and the same goes for Prometheus. And frankly, I welcome it.
What are you doing, David?
I'm attempting to open the door.
Wait. We don't know what's on the other side.
Oops. Sorry.
David does whatever he pleases. Well, sort of. This is our first hint that David does not serve the crew. Or at least he can choose whether to follow their directives or not. He serves Wayland first and foremost. All other directives are secondary. What's fascinating about David in this film in particular is that there is much ambiguity, not unlike Ash. Is this a machine merely following orders, or is he operating under his own will? David is very repressed in Prometheus. He's quite catty, but in a restrained way. Ultimately, he is forced to be polite. Audience reactions to him during the years between Prometheus and Covenant were interesting. Many felt optimistic that, after he was free of his cruel master, he might change for the better. Others didn't trust him at all. It was impossible to know for certain whether he was cruel by his own volition, or only under Wayland's guidance. Many empathise with him and tend to take a more sympathetic view of his situation. But really, even in this scene, he has selfish motivations. Opening that door is an action that would please Wayland, but it also satisfies his own curiosity. He's always working his own agenda in there. And now I describe that scenario in that way. Doesn't that sound a bit like Ash? Opening a door that puts the crew in danger, satisfying his own curiosity and the directives of the company. I think seeing something even vaguely humanoid on the other side of the galaxy, or thereabouts, would be much scarier to me than some completely alien creature. The latter I would have expected, but finding a giant statue that looks basically human? That's terrifying. That raises a lot of questions. It would make me uneasy about my entire sense of reality forevermore. As a kid, I only ever watched certain movies to see the cool monster design. Sometimes I would even skip to the end just to see the alien or the werewolf or whatever it was. I had no interest in humans running around crying and screaming. And while I will always have a love for great creature design, the older I get, the scarier human beings become. In some ways, the engineers are scarier than the xenomorph, because this looks like a being we vaguely recognize and should therefore be able to reason with, and yet we can't. I find something like American Psycho or Hannibal infinitely scarier than something like the Babadook, as good as it was, for that very reason. I mentioned a few episodes back that we see about six engineers running into this room. Where did they go? In this minute, we get a fairly decent look at this room. Sure, it's dimly lit, but all the doors are massive in this place. If there was another exit, we should be able to spot it with ease. The pup seems to do a sweep of the entire circular room, then leaves through the only door available. All the urns seem to be in perfect order. There are no signs of chaos in this room. And based on this limited evidence, I would suppose the most likely scenario is that they hid in this room, waited for the danger to pass, and simply left. What that danger was, we may never know. How could they have been certain that it was ever safe to come out? Perhaps there were more engineers who were elsewhere in the temple and they took care of the threat. These are all just potential scenarios. All we know for sure is that they were running for their lives, they hid in the nearest room, and one of them was injured or dying and was unnecessarily beheaded by a non-occupational health and safety approved door. Speaking of the layout of this place, I don't think there's evidence one way or the other, but we see a row of temples when the Prometheus landed. Are they all connected to each other? If so, perhaps there are many more dead or hibernating engineers hidden in the other structures. To say nothing of the rest of the planet, did they only colonize this one small area? Or Did they spread out across the entire planet? Seeing the helmet close up, it looks so convincingly like a skull, right down to the eye sockets and even a fibrous joint running along the centre of the crown. Side note, did you know that in old age, our skulls can sometimes lose those sutures or joints entirely? Old skulls can become pure bone, and it's one of the ways forensics can tell how old a person was when they died. Anyway, of course we know this isn't a skeleton, but clearly that was the look they were going for. There are a few possibilities as to why the engineers would pursue such a design, based on behaviours we have witnessed in human cultures. One, they look to nature for inspiration. Given how organic their architecture is, this is plausible. This may have been based on the skeleton of some creature from their own planet, which I will expand upon in the next minute. Possibility two, they are a death-worshipping culture and use death iconography in much of their designs. Again, the macabre seems to be a common element in their culture. Or three, they don't make their armour, they grow it. Given how they manipulate life, it's not impossible that they somehow grow organic armour. In fact, everything about the engineer world seems grown, not built. But this is pure speculation. Just an observation on the script from the previous episode. Holloway being able to quote Bible passages from memory, what is it with that trope? Everyone just seems to have memorized the exact passages they need for highly specific scenarios they find themselves in. I was looking at photos from the original Alien, and I was thinking about how, in some ways, it's timeless, and in other ways, it's undeniably 70s. It made me wonder how Prometheus will age and what will stand out to future audiences as being distinctly from the early 2010s. 6 years later, it still feels very chic. I have to wonder if part of that has to do with the designers being influenced by the 1960s. Something that's already a throwback to another era tends to age better than something contemporary. Future by way of the past. The only thing I'd say that is starting to look dated is Holloway's wardrobe, but I think that may be by design. You know, he's meant to be a bit of a douchebag hipster, so that's probably intentional. We can connect what he's wearing with clothing we've seen people in real life wear, so we have our own personal associations with it. Whereas, if you look at the rest of the cast in Prometheus, very few of them are really evoking specific contemporary trends, so that helps it to be a little bit more timeless and ambiguous. If I had to place bets though, I actually think Covenant will age better than Prometheus, mostly because it plays it very safe. Everything is utilitarian and militaristic, and then David's world is very clearly referencing Gothic horror, so referencing something so before anyone's time as to not have any personal associations. But who can say? Maybe 20 years from now, new viewers will think both look distinctly of their era. And personally, I'm curious to know how these films will be received by the next generation. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson, signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.